Thanks. Okay. So, first question. Any questions from last time, or any questions about homework or logistical matters? I have the homework to give back. I'll give back at the end of class. There was some question from a student about when projects are due. Projects are due the last day of classes. Okay, which is the last day of class. I believe is the day before the last day of classes. Okay, and so that means before finals week. And so if you wanted to do it the last day of class, that would be good. If you wanted to then figure out that you're going to be late, you have an extra 24 hours or so after that. Any questions? Okay. Good. So last couple of classes, we've been talking about sort of proteins, sort of in a proteomics world. And we spent the last class talking about finding motifs. And one of there were sort of two applications of finding motifs. One of them was for basically determining where in DNA did a protein bind. Okay, and there we were looking for sort of basic motifs in DNA, patterns that occurred often across a lot of different upstream gene regions. Another thing we might want to do is if we had a bunch of proteins that were in the same family in some sense, that they all basically look like they do the same thing, we might like doing their same thing means that they basically bind to a particular other class of proteins, presumably in the same way. So maybe this is a hemoglobin molecule in human, in chimpanzee, in dog, in chicken, everybody's got hemoglobin. And one of the things that, and presumably there are relatively small parts of the molecule that bind with other protein molecules, and that sort of governs what they do. And so the motif in a protein molecule is determining the small parts of the protein that are highly conserved that govern, basically interacting with other proteins. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? So what I'd like to talk about today is continue a little bit in the same line. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the interactions of proteins and proteins. Can you turn out one of the lights? Do that. And specifically the problem of protein, so basically looking at proteins as shapes for the purposes of analyzing their interactions. Okay, so the idea of protein shapes and protein docking is what I want to talk about today. And so what do we know about protein shapes? We know that the secondary structure of the protein tells us where these helices are and these sheets. We know the tertiary structure of the protein in some sense specifies the three-dimensional structure of it, the coordinates in space. What we now like to do is give it the 2D or even better the 3D structure of a protein, or of a collection of proteins. We'd like to figure out how do they interact. Okay, how do these shapes interact? And this is sort of important. One reason this is very important is in drug design. Okay, a lot of, the reason why a lot of illnesses are caused by the fact that maybe you're not making a particular protein that you should be making. Okay, or maybe the protein that you're making is damaged in some way. There's there may be some polymorphism in the protein that your genes may be the fact that you're making a protein that is not in quite the right shape in order to properly interact with it. What you would like to do, so a lot of drug design is sort of basically of the form. Here is an important protein. In the real world, the disease is caused either because this protein is interacting with another protein that it shouldn't, or because there isn't a protein to you're not making enough of the protein that should be interacting with this. and trying to figure out where the potential interaction sites are on these proteins is sort of at the heart of sort of drug design. Okay? In general, obviously
drug design is very important because, you know, you cure people. It's very important because drug companies make a lot of money, so that's important. Okay, it drives research. So there's two different kinds of in the protein docking problem, we're trying to take two proteins and figure out how they might interact based on their shape. And there's sort of going to be two different classes of problems that I think people typically look at here. One is, if I give you two proteins, which are rigid, presumably fairly rigid things, two large, fairly rigid things, try to figure out where they interact. Okay, so maybe I would be saying sort of like, here you have a lock, here you have a key, try to figure out where the key goes into the lock. The second problem is where you're given a, there's different classes. In one case, you might be given two fairly rigid proteins, okay, and figure out how they interact. Another thing is we might be given a protein molecule, a big protein molecule, and a relatively small molecule that we want to see how it interacts with the big molecule. Why do we worry about small molecules in drug design? Well, first of all, small molecules, as I understand it, okay, have somehow, in order for a drug to work, it's got to get to where it's going to be useful. Okay, you swallow a pill, somehow there's got to be some way that the stuff from that pill has to get into the part of the cell where that protein is interacting. Okay, and so there are a lot of questions about when you design a protein, it's not enough necessarily a drug, it's not necessarily enough that in a test tube it interacts with the desired protein, but that somehow it'll be able to get where it wants to go. And in general, small molecules, okay, are easier to pass through membranes and things like this. So most drug design consists of designing relatively small molecules designed to interact with large molecules. And these small molecules also have the property that they are somewhat flexible because they're fairly small. They don't have as much as much structure sort of one, you know, outside the basic chain. There's less structure to it. These things are sort of free to wiggle around. We call these small molecules that are sort of flexible ligands. And so another sort of problem is not just given two big, proteins, how do you interact? But given one big protein and one small flexible thing, how might this interact with that? Okay, so there's slightly different kinds of problems. Any questions? Good. And so the basic kind of docking problems are, one, to figure out grossly where they interact, and second, what is the point where how do you figure out the orientations where they maximally interact? So I guess the difference between these two problems would be,
you can imagine saying that, given as input, you've got protein A and protein B, where do they interact? You might say, well, this part binds with that part. And that would be an answer to a docking question. A harder docking question might be to say, sort of, now maximize, show me how they really do interact. And that might be aligning this with figuring out what is the actual interaction, the actual orientation of both the molecules, so as to maximize that interaction. Okay? Any questions? The question of where something grossly interacts might be a much easier problem than actually solving the full, three-dimensional, doing the full problem in geometry. Maybe you identify some feature here. Hey, it looks like this is a hole, and hey, it looks like this is a peg. Okay? And you might be able to do that feature recognition without doing the full geometric manipulation. Any questions? So this is the whole question of docking. Now, when we start talking about analyzing the geometry of these proteins, we have to be
careful, thinking about what the problem looks like depends a lot upon what the input representation of the protein is. Okay, I mean, when we talked about protein folding, the representation I talked about most was this idea that we're going to represent the folded protein by a chain of angle bond pairs. Okay? And this, I said, was if you knew the distance between that each bond represented, okay, the distance of each link in the chain, and you knew the chain angles, that basically gave you the three-dimensional position of the backbone, you know, the backbone of the protein. So you might have this representation. You might model it instead as being an interaction of a bunch of spheres in space. So it might be that instead you model the shape of the protein instead of just by the backbone.
Maybe at each one of these, amino acid residue, you model it by a sphere. And the size of the sphere might be related to the size of the amino acid residue and something like this. This is a different geometric representation. Okay, and just sort of modeling it as a chain. Or we might just model it as three-dimensional points in space. Maybe we just know the positions from some crystallographic study. Maybe we know the positions of all the atoms, okay, or all the amino acid residues, but maybe we don't know how they're connected. Or we'll ignore how they're connected in order to simplify this to make it more of a geometric problem. Maybe you've got a cloud of space, and that's points in space, and that's your representation of the protein. What I'll argue is that somehow all of these representations are somewhat of a fiction, because these are molecules. And again, we saw a couple classes ago the nice movie of this protein wiggling around trying to find its conformation. My sense is that proteins, their molecules, things wiggle and vibrate, and electrons are moving around. Okay, these things are not, connected meatballs. Okay, they're things that move and vibrate and bend. Okay, and so in some sense, trying to figure out the protein interactions are a geometric problem because we are dealing with shapes. In another sense, we're not really dealing with standard what I consider to be the kind of things that you really make geometry out of. Okay, I mean geometry. If you talk to a computational geometer, they are very interested in knowing about shapes. They work with shapes, algorithms on shapes, geometric structures. And these structures are well-defined and they're rigid. And that may or may not be the case in really modeling what a protein does. In fact, proteins, again, these bonds are flexible. So in fact, there is a certain amount of bending that they can do. So that's what we saw in the protein folding movie from a few classes ago. The protein would wiggle and form into its conformation. If it was going to interact with another protein were to come along, that might very well move some of those amino acids around in order to make a tighter, snugger fit. Okay? And that kind of that sort of makes it not completely a geometric problem anymore, because we're dealing with flexible things. Okay? Any questions? So the point, I guess, that I want to make is that we're dealing with problems. When you look about how do proteins interact, we're dealing with something that is sort of a geometric problem, but not completely a geometric problem. Okay? And that, that of course, like everything else, that makes it harder to solve. Okay? Any questions? Okay. So, but let's talk a little bit about geometry and computation on geometry. And to give us some ideas how we might, some computational tools that we might use to model the shapes of proteins and things. And the first thing to know is that the shape of something is not, that the shape of something represented by partial data is not a completely well-defined concept. Okay, so if I take a look at those points, you have this cloud of points here. What is the shape of those points? Does anyone want to guess what those points form? Okay, yeah. Looks like the letter A. Okay, I think I believe, how many people believe those points form the shape of the letter A? Okay, how many people don't believe it? Okay,
No one's saying they don't believe it.
Okay. So yes, looking at this thing, we can view that and say that is a letter A. But when you say, what is the essence of this shake that makes it the letter A? Okay, this is something that's not clear to me. I mean, when, you know,
I'm right now teaching my 2.5-year-old girl the alphabet. She could point out letter A. She's good at that one.
Okay. But I mean, you know, a letter A is what? It's straight line, straight line, straight line. This is triangular hole. Okay? I don't see straight lines here. Okay? At least in the cloud of points. Okay? I don't see a triangular hole. Okay? So, somehow the idea of doing,
of capturing shape from, let's say, a cloud of points, okay, these points might represent amino acid residues, to try to abstract what the shape of that is not an easily defined problem, okay? What you would really like if you're, you know, as a computer scientist, okay, if you want to do a program to match shapes, you'd like to say, okay, here is a protein description. Give me the shape of that. Okay, and the important thing to see here is you have to be a little bit specific what you mean by shape. Do you mean the interacting pattern? You have these spheres that are intersecting, and that glob of spheres is the shape? Or is it a smoother shape? Is it what? Okay? So when we talk about geometry, we need to talk about operators that we can do on, let's say, a data set. Typically, a cloud of points is a perfectly reasonable geometric data set. Okay, describing, let's say, the center of the amino acid residues, or maybe each set, you know, it might be that each, you know, each atom might be represented by a dot here. This might be a higher resolution map of a protein than we had seen before. Okay? The question of how you assign a set of a cloud of points a shape, okay, you need a concept for that. And, the standard sort of first geometric concept that you come up with to represent, take points and convert them to shape is something called the convex hull. The way I think of what a convex hull is in two dimensions would be that if you had these points were nails sticking out of the, out of a block of wood, the head of a nail sticking out of the block of the wood, and you stretch a rubber band over it and let go, ka-chung, the rubber band will squash in, okay? The convex hull would be this outer shape here, okay? And it's sort of a well-defined mathematical object, okay? It says basically the convex hull is a set of points which defines the smallest in two dimensions convex polygon, in three dimensions convex polyhedra, okay, that contains all the points, okay? And so this I claim, so the convex hull is the shape of lines around it. Okay? Yeah. Right, so here what I'm assuming, this is a two-dimensional picture. Okay, so this is a convex hull in two dimensions. The same concept would in principle hold in three dimensions. You wouldn't have a rubber band so much. You could think of it as being, what would you think of it as? You have sort of a balloon. I guess maybe you have all the points are within a balloon. There's sort of these points sticking out in space. You have a big balloon on the outside of it. And, you know, I blew it up so the balloon is over the points. And now let the air out and the balloon is going to somehow shrink over the points, shrink wrap the points. The convex hull is what you would get by shrink wrapping it. And, you know, basically what it is it's the smallest convex area, convex polygon / polyhedra that contains all the points. Okay? And this is sort of a well-defined notion of shape that is fairly easy to compute. Okay? Any questions? How many people have seen the concept of convex hull before? How many people have never seen the concept of convex hull? Okay, a few, okay. Other pockets in the room. Okay? So how can you... But the convex hull has the property that it's relatively easy to compute. Okay, how might you compute it? Probably the simplest algorithm would be something like what we call a Gibbs wrapping algorithm. Okay, where you know that the lowest leftmost point has to be on the convex hull. Why? Because somehow that's got to be on the outside. You know, clearly that if you have this thing coming down, the lowest point is going to clearly be on the hull. So you can start out from the lowest point and sort all the points by angle and figure out which point has the lowest angle with respect to this thing. If this is the origin, the one with the lowest angle that it defines is going to be on the convex hull. So you can walk along from here to here and find which point is on the hull. Now you can sort all the points again with respect to this point and identify which is the one that is lowest, which is the one that has the smallest angle, and walk around the hull one by one, wrapping each face one by one. The time that that should take is basically going to be the number of faces on the hull times the number of points in the hull, because you don't really have to sort all the points in each direction. You only have to find which one has the lowest angle. And by sweeping through all the points, you can figure out which one has the lowest angle in each iteration. So certainly in n times the number of faces on the outer side of the hull, you can do it in the plane. And a similar kind of argument would algorithm would hold in three dimensions. You know that the lowest point on the hull is going to be the lowest point overall is going to be on the hull. Once you find one face of the hull, you can then wrap it around by sort of swinging on each edge of that space, rotating up and seeing where is the first point that you contact. That sort of describes what they would call a gift wrapping algorithm. It's like if this hull was a gift, this A was a gift you wanted to give somebody, how would you wrap it? Well, you would start by here, you would wrap the paper around, and so on. So convex hull is a well-defined thing, okay? It's an easy thing to program, okay? It's an easy thing to do. And it gives you some sort of a notion of shape of the set of points, okay? So we can very, very easily take the cloud of points associated with a protein and compute its convex hull and say that is the shape of the protein. What is bad potentially, though, about using the convex hull as a shape? Okay, does this convex hull really capture the shape of this thing? Okay? It doesn't take into account the holes, where you define a hole as being a well-defined, something that's somehow topologically distinct here. Okay? And this concavity here. Okay, this is a concavity, not really a hole, but I think of this as being a concavity. You miss the concavity, you miss internal holes. Okay? And you have to be, and so somehow the real notion of shape should really capture this. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Any ideas how we can come up with a richer idea of what shape is? Okay? To somehow map the shape. So that we do pick up these holes. Okay? What kind of things might we do? The contours, and so what do you mean by contour?
It's kind of bounded between the bounded velocity and the bounded velocity.
Right. Okay, so somehow what you're sort of saying is that this thing really I should be walking along here. This is what the shape is. Okay? What you're sort of saying. And that if I could sort of walk along the outer part of the boundary, maybe I could pick up this sort of contour line. Okay? Okay. So that's potentially a reasonable thing. Although, of course, before you program that, you've got to be a little bit more specific about what you mean by a contour along that shape. Okay? You know, I mean, it's, how are you going to define that this point is part of this point? You know, it's not at all clear to me how you decide. It's not necessarily the case that it's the closest point to this. You know, why would we know that from here we're supposed to turn in rather than turn this way? Okay? It's not clear to me. Okay? You have to come up with some kind of a description of that. But even if you do that, you probably get just the contour here. You don't get the inner hole of the A.
Okay.
Why not? Okay, so what are you defining as contour, though? Let's think about this.
Well, a segment
such that on one side of it everything belongs to the shape. Well, but now by that definition, is this really a part of your contour? Because these things are not part of. I mean, if you draw a contour here, All this stuff is to the left of your shape. All this is to the right of your shape. Is that really, I mean, is that a contour? Well, but there is stuff to the right of it.
Okay, yes.
One idea I have, and would be to
a Voronoi diagram.
Yeah, do something like that, and look for like areas where the polygons in that are smaller than a certain size. That would be like part of the shape.
So what you're saying is, actually, that you're saying that somehow what's interesting here is that you've got a large area where there's no points, okay? That you're looking somehow for holes, okay? That if you could find large empty plate, empty spheres, or empty regions, that would be a potential characterization of shape, okay? Yeah. Right, so then you have to define what's large. So, for example, what is large enough to be interesting? Okay, yeah.
I think it might make sense to be able to find ways to understand all segments, all triangles, I mean, all such segments that the world wants to one triangle, that this triangle is on the border of the shape.
Okay, so what you're saying is you want to triangulate all these points. Okay, and again, by triangulation,
what you're saying here is maybe given our points, you want to triangulate the points. So here I'm triangulating them. I don't see where my hole is really obvious here. Okay, and I would certainly, in the course of my triangulation,
add a triangle in there. Okay, you may
see
it's large and skinny, and that's not.
Okay,
so okay, you can discard. But let's again, yeah, right. A minimum spanning tree. What would minimum spanning tree likely do with this thing? Okay, that's sort of potentially an interesting idea. Or building what you would say is some kind of a nearest neighbor structure. What would the minimum spanning tree of this thing look like? Okay? Well, we certainly wouldn't include any things spanning this area or spanning that area. Okay? So that is kind of an interesting idea. Okay? What we would probably get for the minimum spanning tree,
well, first of all, we wouldn't get any cycles in the minimum spanning tree. Why is that? Because there's no cycles, okay, in a tree. But you're probably going to get something that's going to look sort of like this, okay? You know, you have the furry things going out of it, you know, you're going to have, somehow it's going to look sort of something. So there's some kind of connectivity you get from the minimum spanning tree, okay? It's not immediately clear how you go from that to holes, okay? But somehow what minimum spanning tree does seem to do a little bit, or equivalently finding nearest neighbors, that's basically what you're trying to do. Is for every point connecting it to its nearest neighbor and seeing what happens. That will capture some sort of a notion of, well, somehow it seems like it should capture some kind of notion of that of shape. I don't yet see what to do with it. Okay, but you know, it's not implausible. Yeah. Well, it's an embedded tree. I mean, this is clearly a tree that's embedded in the plane. But of course, the other thing that's to know is that we do want something geometric at the end of this, because our biologist is going to want to tell whether this protein molecule interacts with that protein molecule based on shape. So this is sort of a topological characterization, but it's not really a shape yet. Okay? So I think this has been interesting. I mean, we have some ideas as to how you might do it.
But what's clear is somehow that the whole notion of what a shape is not a well-defined thing. Yeah. But laying a grid on it, what about laying a grid on it? Okay.
Okay, so what you want to say here is you want to pixelate the thing. You want to print it you want to say basically, here I've got a bunch of points. You're going to lay a grid down. And any hole that gets connected is going to be, cells are going to get filled in on the basis of where there are voids. And your home is somehow that, well, now you've got this connected grid structure, maybe if there's a hole in there. So now you're saying that thing is for our A. What you're hoping to come out of from our A is something like this.
And you've got blobs here. And another one just so you take the sensation.
Somehow what you're hoping to do is to see something like this. And now maybe you can say connectivity-wise that, look, this is now topologically distinct. There's an inside and an outside. So maybe that's a hole, okay? And maybe now, this thing, you can get into... Well, what might be problems with that approach? That's not an unreasonable thing to do. But what problems are there? Okay, yeah. One thing that sets a black art to me is how do you pick the appropriate grid size? Because if you pick the grid size too small, you're going to get disconnected things. And if you pick the grid size too large, you're going to get a blob. It's going to be filled in. Okay? So, if my grid was 1 pixel, okay, I've got a blob. Okay? So that's, and it's not something that you can move back and forth, correctly getting the topological characterization that you want. Okay? So that's some idea, but again, it's not clear if it's the right or wrong idea. Okay? So, any other ideas that have come to us? Yeah?
The idea of contours, okay, what about the contours?
So I break the sections of the domain. The contour is the right side of the left leg of the A.
Yeah? So you're going to walk along this somehow.
Yeah, so that contour is like everything serves the left leg. It doesn't belong to the shape and everything to the right belongs to the shape. And where the right contour is, everything towards the right doesn't belong to the shape.
Okay, so somehow what you're looking for is some kind of a separating walk with the idea that anything that's not on, that's on the outside of the walk is pretty far away. I'm sort of saying. You want to try to find a walk along these points with the property that all the points are either on this side or so far away that that they might as well be invisible. Okay. Here, again, that may be a reasonable thing, but it's clear that we're coming up with some reasonable ideas, but somewhat ad hoc ideas. It's very easy to come up with ad hoc ideas. Somehow shape should be a beautiful thing. I mean, somehow shape should be something that is well-defined. Everybody here knew that was an A, okay? And how do we get to the inherent A-ness of this, okay, from just looking at the points? So somehow, again, it's not a clean problem and not an easy problem. There is a formalism, however, that's very nice. It's fairly widely used.
It was developed by my advisor, okay, who was Herbert Edelsbrunner, who's now at Duke University.
So it has to do with a notion called an alpha shape. Okay, we basically have this, and I think Tom actually sort of was hinting a little bit at that kind of an idea. We want something that is a generalization of the convex hull, but will capture sort of a wider idea of shapes. Okay? And what an alpha hull is, it's a notion of shape where the parameter is defined, where it's defined by the points and a parameter. Okay? Some value of alpha. Where alpha is the radius of a sphere. Okay? In two dimensions, a sphere is a circle. In three dimensions, a sphere is a sphere. Okay? But what we're going to say here is, we're going to say that a face is exposed, okay, an edge of the alpha hull is exposed, okay, if there are two or three points, okay, two points in two dimensions, 3 points in three dimensions, such that a sphere of radius alpha, okay, will not contact, can touch those two points and contain no internal points. Okay? So it's this idea that we're going to have this, our shape is going to be defined by this parameterized alpha, the sphere radius. Okay? And depending upon what value we turn the knob to, we're going to be trying to capture regions that are connected, large regions, by whether or not they are contained, are empty, meaning that they have a sphere of that size fits in the region. Okay? Or specifically, if there are in the plane two points on the boundary, two points such that if you nestle that sphere against those two points, it contains no other points of the data set. Okay, that is the idea of an alpha hull. Okay? So what is an alpha hull for an arbitrarily large, for a humongous sphere? Suppose alpha is infinite. What is the alpha hull, the shape of an alpha hull, if we have this huge sphere, this infinitely large sphere, the Earth or Jupiter, okay, or something, the Sun, okay, that we're rolling along these point sets? What is that going to look like, okay, for the shape that we get? Okay? Any intuition? What? This, okay, point, the convex hull. Why is that? Well, there's this giant sphere that we're rolling around. It's so big that its edges look like it's they're flat. You know, when you get close to it, if I look at this, the Earth is a pretty big sphere. I don't see the roundness of it, right? It's flat where I'm standing, okay? And likewise, if we push the Earth up to any pair of points, okay, it would be, look like a flat line. And so we're really now moving the Earth around these points, okay, and seeing where can we roll it. We certainly can't fit it inside, okay? But on the other hand, any pair of points on the where you can draw a straight line to separate it from the world, you can roll the sphere up against it and separate it from the world. Okay? So I want to claim that for alpha that is large enough, the shape of the alpha hull is the convex hull. Okay?
Now suppose alpha is very, everybody is sort of agreeing. What if alpha is very, very small? What would be the shape of the shape that we get? Okay? What do we get? The point set itself. Okay?
So we're going from the points in isolation, this tiny little sphere rotating around it, you can't even see it. Okay? Dust. Okay? Can't even see it. Okay? So at one end we get the convex hull, at the other end we get the points themselves. So eventually it's going to be disconnected. That's the first thing to see. So we can make our alpha small enough, this thing's going to break into pieces and be disconnected. Okay? But it also is true that there are a host of shapes in between. And if I pick the value of alpha, what would be a reasonable value of alpha to capture this? Suppose I had a penny. Okay? Ka-chunk. An alpha the size of a penny would capture a lot of this idea on the boundary. It would move into here. And it would also be big enough to notice that there is a concavity, okay, for the A. Okay? And so what our alpha hull does that is very, very nice is it gives us a family of shapes, okay, such that they can be more or less concavity. And there's now a knob you can twist and say, well, you've got a cloud of points. Let me twist the alpha value up and down. And I can stop at a point where I think the geometric result that I get looks like the shape that I want. Okay? Any questions about that? Yeah. I've never heard of it trying to be used for an ellipse. See, one thing that's nice about a sphere or a circle is that there is only one way, given a pair of points, that it's going to be tangent to a circle. There's basically only two ways you can nest it. Either the circle is so small it can rotate around the points independently without containing it, or there is basically only two orientations for that circle.
It can either sit here or it can sit there. Whereas if
you
use an ellipse, now there's lots of different ways you can fly
that ellipse
around. Okay?
So plus ellipses now are two parameters, right? So the world becomes messier with ellipses. It's not clear that it buys me anything. Well, you're saying that what if I have a sausage-shaped hole?
You want to say a hive embeds a sausage shape? I would argue that if you have a sausage-shaped hole, a smaller, a dime, rolling around on the inside of that will consume much of the sausage. Okay, so it's not clear that you need a sausage shape.
You can get sausage shapes out of this without ellipses. Okay? Yeah.
Is alpha a constant, or is this alpha greater than the threshold?
Alpha is a constant. We're asking about roughly rolling around a disk of size alpha. Okay? So we are getting when we get alpha small enough, it gets disconnected. When alpha is large enough, we get the convex hull. Okay? And in between, we've got a family of shapes. Okay? Any questions? So this is a nice thing. Now the only thing that's a little bit problematic about it is that, in fact, what is alpha? Okay? What should the value of the sphere be? Okay?
Can anybody make an idea how you might set alpha? It's not necessarily the best way to do it, but let's think of an idea. What might be an interesting value of alpha?
Average, maybe reflecting the average size of the dots, that might be it. It might be that you might want the smallest distance such that the thing is connected. Okay, that might be something that's interesting. Or maybe so that it's, highly connected or something like that. It's not at all, you come up with some kind of rules of thumb, but probably that's not it's not clear that any of them necessarily hold water. Okay? The thing that is interesting is that, in fact, the algorithm that constructs alpha shapes, in fact, inherently constructs them for all alpha at once. Okay? So what's kind of nice is it's relatively easy to roll through all the shapes. You think about it that there's, originally you had the convex hull. If you let alpha get smaller and smaller, holes are going to get stuck. There's going to be local changes as alpha gets shrinking. Every time alpha shrinks, there's going to be a first place where it makes a difference. And there's sort of a lot of discrete events that happen in making alpha go from convex hull to disjoint points. Okay? And it's almost the algorithm computes all of them. So it's very, very easy to fly through different values of alpha and decide what's interesting. Any questions? So this is just to give you some examples here. So here, for example, is a, in three dimensions, a couple of alpha shapes for a particular protein. And again, these don't show up incredibly well on the slide. But I think what you're supposed to see here, this is sort of a helix-like protein. And when alpha is small enough, you get maybe like the individual helices show up. Okay, it shows up as sort of as a helix. And when you set alpha large enough, you get a connected thing with a hole in it. So the dominant feature now here is, in fact, you do get the tunnel through the center. When alpha is small enough, the dominant feature you get is you actually see the spiral of the helix. Okay? So when you ask which of these shapes is right, well, which is the right shape of the molecule? Is it a helix or is it a tunnel? And I argue that the answer is neither of them. Okay? It's whatever you're interested in. If you're interested in finding pockets, you would want your alpha to be something like this. Okay? And if you're interested in sort of viewing sort of helices as helices, it might be something like this. So that what makes it kind of nice is you've got a parameterized notion of shape. Okay? Any questions? So that's one. Here's another picture where, again, it's a myoglobin molecule. And if you look at this, which you can't because the picture's blurry, maybe you would see that there's a little bit of an indentation here that shows up. And in fact, here's an example of the alpha hull with the alpha shape of another thing that docks with it. And you can sort of see somehow it fits into that shape. Okay? And here's some other pictures I had. Where here was when you took the alpha hull, okay, here somehow when you set alpha properly, there was this little tunnel in the molecule. Okay, and you could find that tunnel by, topological means. Okay, and in fact, that's a binding site for some inhibitor. Any questions?
Yes.
Okay? So this captures some kind of an idea of shape, okay? And now we can live in the world of shape. We can think of these things as, I think of alcohols are very nice structures. If you want to think of them as unions of balls, you can think of them like that, okay? But it gives us a way to now start talking about shapes, okay? And to start thinking about shapes within cavities, okay? Any questions? Okay, good. So, what is the problem of protein-protein docks? So now we have sort of some kind of an idea of the shape of a protein, okay, as being a well enough defined thing to potentially work with. In protein-protein docking, we would like to try to figure out, again, whether one protein docks with another. Where does it match with the other? And in these docking problems, typically, the proteins are modeled as rigid bodies. Now, they're not rigid bodies, but why are they used as rigid bodies? Because the geometry is, the notion of computational geometry is much better established with rigid bodies than things that are soft and can move around. So what you can do is somehow, you know, in these docking problems, you think of these as rigid bodies, and for any particular orientation, you can score the orientation in a couple of different ways. How well does this dock with this? Okay? How would you measure whether this is a good fit if I have one protein here and one protein here? How might you measure that this is a good fit of the other protein? What kind of factors might you consider? You're writing a program that evaluates whether or not these things are in proper position. What might you consider that, you know, how might you measure that? Okay? Yes. Yeah. So maybe you might say, look, here I've got these things are modeled by points, these things are modeled by points. Maybe I want to know what is, for every point on the surface of the thing, what is it in the document, how far am I from something else? Okay? That might be one way. So I might measure the root mean square distance of the points involved. Okay? And of course, in a real document, since these things are somewhat approximate, you would probably like your function to be general enough that there's a certain amount of overlap that you're allowed, right? And these things are somehow free to wiggle. So one way to do it might be you identify what is, for any point on the surface here, what is its closest point on the other surface, and get some kind of a point for that. And you know, so a docking is good if you have a run of a fair number, a chain of a fair number of consecutive points, such that the average root mean distance is small. Okay, that might be one part of your energy calculation. In fact, these things are, in fact, not purely geometric structures. They are molecules, so they are charge issues. They are presumably other electrostatic issues here. You know, you might not want a positively charged thing next to a negatively charged thing. So these negative, you know, there's also questions about, again, compatible amino acid residues, things like this. So in fact, the right measure of how good a docking is involves sort of the energy computations based on how far apart the relevant things are and how far they like to be apart from each other. And how much, make sure there are not any other spurious intersections. So one thing that would be bad would be to have a docking where this part of the molecule docks very nicely with that, but the body of this protein intersects the other one. So in fact, there's somehow the score for a docking is both local and also global. You have to make sure that in general the proteins don't self-intersect. Okay? So in fact, there's two different issues. There's one, the question of how do you measure the quality of a dock locally. And there's also the question of how do you globally represent the space of all possible dockings. Any questions? So when we talk about globally representing dockings, A typical way to describe possible docking is something you would call configuration space. Let's say that I had two proteins that I want to figure out what are all the possible dockings between them. But I was not allowed to rotate either of them. I'm only allowed to translate this guy around. Okay? How can I describe the space of all possible dockings of the two of them? Well, I could say there's a reference point, x, y, okay, 0, 0, let's say, on my, on my, one of my proteins. And then draw a graph where I have a point for all legal positions, all legal places to put that point x, y, such that it doesn't intersect this business. Right? It is probably the case that it would look something like this. These are the illegal positions. Okay, if I move x and y here, it probably is illegal along this boundary. Okay? I think that for every degree of freedom that I have, it's specified in moving around the one that is free to move. I can build a representation of all possible configurations by a diagram in D dimensions, where D is the amount of freedom that I have in sliding around the other one. Okay? Any questions here? I don't know what I'm saying is maybe fuzzy. It may be easy. Okay? So what I can represent the space of possible assignments is to build what you would call a configuration space. Okay? Again, these values are all the possible, if we're allowed translation only, in two dimensions, and we get a two-dimensional configuration space. What if I'm allowed rotation also? What would my configuration space be? If I'm also allowed to rotate this shape in the plane. Okay? Yeah? Now I've got another dimension where for every angle of theta sort of sticking out of the board, okay, I have one of these two-dimensional diagrams. And it may be, for example, that when I rotate this thing 90 degrees, now I'm allowed to stick the thing in deeper. So it might be that when I rotate it up, the configuration space that might be legal for this thing might twist around like a sausage. Okay? And so the way to describe sort of the space of allowable motion, or the space of allowable position, is with one of these configuration space diagrams. Any questions here? Okay? So, in general, if you really want to describe the space of possibilities for a protein, okay, if you have two rigid bodies in three dimensions, there are to move one of them around the other is really a six-dimensional configuration space problem. Why is it six dimensions? Well, translating, if I have a three-dimensional object here and a three-dimensional object here, there are three dimensions to translate this object around the other. There's also three different axes of rotation that you're allowed. Okay? So to actually really, when you allow yourself to sort of rotate, okay, that also gives you other complexities. Okay? And it's full glory, okay, motion planning of two rigid three-dimensional objects is a six-dimensional problem. Okay? And so, quote unquote, the right way to do protein docking would be to build the space, the six-dimensional space of all possibilities. And maybe what you're interested in are the boundaries here. Because the boundary of between where it is legal and where it is illegal is presumably where it is touching. Okay? And so one way to solve these docking problems is to build a configuration space and walk along the boundary of this and say, what looks interesting? Okay? Yes.
But how linear is the energy drink? Like, if you had a certain resolution, and linear is the right word, but if you had a certain resolution, you could then say, okay, these areas look interesting, and then you go to areas with configuration space in higher detail, and it's really good.
Okay, so what you're saying is the six dimensional configuration space is not for you, okay? That somehow is very complicated. It's clearly going to be very big, okay? Doing anything in six dimensions is hard. Doing anything in three dimensions is hard. Doing anything in two dimensions is probably still for a lot of people hard. Okay, I'm good at one dimension, okay? So, so one question is it possible that you can do docking without actually building this whole six-dimensional configuration space? And this is where sort of heuristics and stuff like that start to come in, okay? So, you know, there are lots of different games you can play at this point, okay? And we'll talk a little bit later about some heuristic ways to try to focus attention on the interesting part of the docking, okay, rather than build the whole space, okay? Any questions? Okay. And while we're talking about dimensions, if six dimensions isn't enough for you, let's remember back to the problem where we have flexible ligands. Okay? Where now what we're trying to dock is not a rigid object, but is this hinged beast. Okay? Where this, you know, somehow this is free to wiggle, this is free to wiggle. You've got two hinges defining angles. If you really want to drive all possible configurations of this thing, you've now got an extra two dimensions of freedom, 2 degrees of freedom, okay? Because you also can consider, gee, what the possibilities when this opens up or closes up, okay? So in fact, you know, one of the problems, so
one of the reasons why we don't like to deal with flexibility is more degrees of freedom mean more dimensions in the configuration space. And that keeps making the problem harder and harder. Okay? So, you know, fortunately, when you typically are looking at binding ligands, the object is relatively small. And so you can play some kind of tricks, maybe with rough, you know, to determine rough interactions. Maybe you might want to say, gee, let's just take this part of the molecule. Where does this molecule look like, part of the molecule look like it fits? Where does this part of the molecule look like it fits? If this part of the molecule here, A, is bounded there, and there, and there, and the second part of the molecule, B, is bounded here, here, and here, by looking at the parts, where the parts possibly bind, if you see an area where there's lots of parts that are binding, maybe that's the place where the whole thing can bind. And it needs to say, hey, biologists, here's a good place to look. Or you can say, well, now maybe I'll build a configuration space more carefully around here and look at it more closely. Any questions? Okay? So I'm just trying to give you some kind of measure as to, let's say, what the geometric complexity of these kinds of problems are. Any questions? Because I have respect for good protein docking programs, okay? One of which, by the way, is one that has been developed by a fellow in the Applied Math Department, Ilya Vaxar, called GRAM, which is a protein docking program that is relatively widely used. So, you know, protein docking programs are interesting things. Again, we talked a little bit about the docking criteria. As I said, you know, we can score how good a docking site is by basically you might want to score it on the basis of what is the average distance between sites that are deemed close enough. You might want to just count how many pairs of points are close enough, closer than a threshold. But like I say, you have to factor in attractive and repulsive forces as well. Any questions? Yeah. Well, the question is, can you start with sequence and do this? The answer is you can, in the sense that you can take your sequence, run it through a secondary structure program, then take that output, run it through a three-dimensional structure program, and now take the output from your three-dimensional structure program and try to dock with that. Now, this is why good protein folding programs would be very, very useful. If your protein folding program was good enough, then you could just start with, you know, say, oh, here's an interesting protein I just sequenced. Let's go use his program, see how it folds up, okay, and now let's use Vaxor's program and see where my potential drug sticks to it. And so long as your protein folding program is good enough that you will see that interesting site, then you will be happy. And if it isn't, then you're not happy, okay? So a lot of these, so basically the answer is you can start with sequence, but then you've got to trust your folding program. Okay? Of course, if you have crystallographic data, then you'll be more accurate here. Okay? But it depends upon what your problem is, what you're trying to do. You don't have the more accurate knowledge about too many more proteins. So this is one, probably the biggest reason why people care about protein folding. Is that, the people who have the money in this business are the drug companies. Okay? And if you could do protein folding accurately, it would greatly speed up the point of finding potentially interesting interactions, okay? So just the reason that you state. Any questions? Okay? So there's actually this whole question of degrees of freedom and the people who do docking. Again, there's different kinds of computer. One of the things that's interesting about, I find interesting about computational biology is that,
different kinds of computer scientists rear their heads at different problems in the process, okay? When we were doing string matching, the algorithms people jumped up, said, yes, I do text string, Boyer Moore, Knuth Morris Pratt, okay?
When we started doing these fuzzy gene recognition problems, suddenly these AI people started jumping up and down and saying, oh, yes, I match, I know how to, learn data, and I'll learn patterns I don't understand, okay? When you start talking about protein docking and things like that, the people who get excited about this turn out to be from the robotics community. Okay? Because they're the ones that have the experience in trying to predict geometric interactions, okay, and plan motions. Okay, so the motion planning problem, which is clearly of importance in robotics, is you have some kind of an environment. Okay, you have some kind of a robot. Okay, and you'd like to have that figure out how can that robot move from here to here without bunking into anything in the environment. Okay, that is something that's that is inherent, basically the motion planning problem. Okay, and the robotics community is used to doing these kind of things. I don't know if you've ever seen you've probably seen these photographs of like these robot arms doing things in the automotive industry.
Okay, where you have this robot hand picking up a part here, swinging around underneath the, this ledge to avoid hitting the car, moving inside to the window, turning its wrist, and installing the part before getting out without hitting the car again. Those are extremely difficult problems, okay?
And they're solved in the same way that we basically had described about. Basically, this idea of building a configuration space.
What are the possible, there the space, the dimensions of the joint space and the, angles, again, you have angles governing each joint, okay? Usually in the robot arm, the length of the joint, the limbs are fixed, but you've got all these angles. And
trying to plot a movement that avoids any bumping into anything while getting from here to the point inside the car. This is exactly what the people who program those robots are doing have sort of solved and worked on. So they have actually, there are systems that do reasonably good jobs at motion planning, even in high degrees of freedom. Okay? And so this is something to sort of respect. One way that you could do these kind of, build these motion planning systems would be with the method that we've outlined. Basically, take a look at the geometry here. Build this full configuration space. Determine what the exact shape of these boundaries are. And then do a shortest path between the two places that you want. Okay, that avoids the inside of that boundary. That's one way to do it.
But you're doing sort of very complicated calculations in 12 dimensions or so. This is a difficult thing to do. The way that actually the most practical motion planning systems these days work, okay, is with what I think kind of an interesting idea called basically building a roadmap. Okay? Suppose, let's say, that our configuration space in reality looked like this. These are the forbidden areas. This is in some sort of two-dimensional joint world where this is my elbow and this is my wrist. And I want to move my arm from here to here. Okay? How can I try to solve such a problem? Well, I could determine the exact boundaries of this space, but in high dimensions, that's going to be fairly complicated. The shape of this boundary, there are going to be weird surfaces and things like that. Any other ideas how you might do it without actually building that boundary? Anybody come up with an idea? How you might figure out how I can move the arm from here to here without explicitly building that boundary? Yeah? Well, trial and error, okay, but what does trial and error do? That's one basic idea. You could sort of keep swapping joints around and randomly walk. But randomly walk, you know, God knows, you know, where you're going to end up bumping off of. Okay, yeah.
It seems like trying to move some sort of structure on,
okay, but that's now another idea. One might say, and this is essentially probably the right idea, I say random is probably better, but basically, you could impose a grid on the thing and ask yourself, do a calculation to say, if I move the arm into this position, would I be bumping into something or not? Okay? And my basic computation is going to be, given a point in this configuration space, does it correspond to the inside or outside my region? Okay, and these kind of computations are relatively easy to do. I mean, this is basically now, given two geometric configurations, do they intersect? Okay? And so that's a perfectly reasonable thing. You can figure out what points grid points are outside the boundary. Does that give you enough information yet? On a route from here to there? You need to also be able to ask yourself, is it possible to get from here to there? Okay? And so I might do that by doing a bunch of finer motions. I keep sampling on the straight line from this here to there. You know, if all I have is something to tell me do the two things intersect, I could sample very finely from here to there and say, well, none of them do, then I have an edge between this. And so I can build a graph where there are the vertices of my graph are points in free space, in configuration space. And there's edges between pairs of points that I know I can move along. And then the problem of finding the route from here to here is basically asking, is there a path in the graph from this point to that point? Or ideally, what is the shortest path in the graph from this point to that point? Okay? And so I reduce my problem to basically doing, is this point legal or not legal? Computations. And that's not so complicated to do. Okay? Any questions? So the art of these roadmap instructions is, how do I sample my points? So that I sample a lot of points in the interesting part of the configuration space and avoid the boring parts of the configuration space. The boring parts of the configuration space are the parts where I already have a bunch of free spaces. Okay? You know, and so it becomes a sampling issue with things like that. Any questions?
Okay, so there are, so that's sort of how the motion planning community sort of does this kind of thing. And they do it pretty reasonably well. But again, there's other kind of heuristics that we can talk about. One is we can simplify everything by putting it on a grid. That's what we've sort of, people have hit on at various points. Another possibility is to try to identify, if we wanted to solve a docking problem.
Maybe to try to figure out where might the interesting docking parts. I want to figure out, here I've got a protein, here I've got another protein. Where does this dock with that? If it docks, it presumably docks in a pocket. And so one thing that I might want to do to simplify my analysis is ask, here I've got a sphere of a particular size. Where can I lay the sphere on the outside of my surface such that the sphere is not going to self-intersect? So for example, if I have a protrusion like this, maybe my protein looks like this. It is the case that I can't fit a, the only place that I can start to fit a big sphere are outside here. And so maybe by first taking a look at my protein model and figuring out where can I dock a sphere, which is a nice simple object, I can identify what are the potentially accessible parts of the protein. Okay?
And that's potentially helpful. Any questions?
One other idea, which is kind of an interesting idea, is an idea that they call geometric hashing. Okay? Which is the following.
Well, let's say I want to figure out where this cloud of points docks with this cloud of points. Okay? Presumably when they finally kiss each other, there's going to be a nice, let's say, flat a surface where each feature on protein A is going to match up with a feature on protein B. Okay? So what I might want to figure out, and an interesting thing to do, would be I might want to find out for all pairs, all triangles, formed by three points in each structure, where are there very similar sized triangles between this structure and that structure? Okay? So if I have n points here, there's n cubed possible triangles, which is a lot, but not an unbelievably large amount. N is 100 or 1,000, it's not so unbelievably right now. I could now build up a list of all triangles, okay, and they can be parameterized by, I can put them in buckets based on mostly how big they are and grossly, what the angles are, okay? I can now take the set of triangles from here and the set of triangles from there, put them in some hash table. So maybe each triangle goes into one or a small number of buckets in this hash table. And whenever I have triangles from different sizes, from different proteins going to the same box, they potentially represent a similar structure of points. And this might be used to help anchor the general shape of these things. Okay, any questions about it? Okay? So the bottom line is there are a bunch of ideas here that can be used to try to solve these kinds of problems, but that they are it is somewhat of a tricky business. Any questions? Any questions at all? The last thing I guess I'd like to say about the motion planning people and the protein folding people is that there is a point that came up in the movie that she showed was that not only is he interested in somehow what is the final shape, but he's sort of interested in how it got there. Okay, that he, I say it's true. Okay, it's not just the same case that he wants to. Final shape of the protein, but this is something that's folded. He wants to try to predict what the dynamics were. How is it that it got into this final configuration? So you might imagine that, you might think of that as being a motion planning problem, where you've got an input originally, a long chain of amino acids. You've got at the end, a folded up chain of amino acids. Okay? And you may now ask yourself, can you plot a motion that takes this configuration to that configuration? In the course of doing that, all the points are going to bend, okay? And in some sense, it's going to come up with a cap from here to there. Okay? And that path might well describe the way that the folding is actually happening in nature. Okay? You probably need more evidence than just a folding. But maybe like one is a group at Texas A&M led by Nancy Amato that's doing this kind of thing, where she's building up one of these random roadmaps to help guide her search. So for every protein, she's starting out from the original spray, she's ending up with that shape. She builds 1,000 different random roadmaps, okay? Finds the best folding along that roadmap, and watches how the molecule got folded, okay? And based on what the majority of those foldings, those trajectories do. So make some kind of guess about how it is that the protein is actually folded. Is it a good guess? Is it a bad guess? It's a better guess than I can make. Maybe it's not as good a guess as it seems to make. Okay, except that if you can work with much larger things than you do with this dynamic calculator. Okay? And so again, I think it's an interesting example how again a disjoint community, the robotics people, can get into this world because it's a different kind of it's a problem that when you look at it properly, really is no different than bending an arm in a robot. Any questions? Okay. That said, thanks for your attention, and I guess I'll see you guys next class. Oh, I have homework, the homework assignment too, so you feel free to come and pick them up. Okay, thank you.